Hi guys, and welcome to Health Tech Matters. Today our guest is Liam Carter-Hawkins, ex-lead product designer at Babylon Health. He's been working in numerous healthcare products previously. Interesting fact, Liam studied Mandarin Chinese in Beijing. Welcome to the podcast, Liam.
You're working remotely right now?
Really ironic, actually. I recently bought a flat and I'm renovating it at the minute. So it's currently a building site, you know, because I'm ripping everything out and redoing it all. And, you know, up until this point, I've always pushed for remote work. I think remote work is absolutely the way forward. But ironically, when I joined this company, which is remote first, I got my place renovated. So I'm back in the office every day. However, it'll be interesting to see how changes when my flat is done. I'll probably come into the office maybe once or twice a week, and then, you know, work remote. It'll be hybrid.
Yeah. Sure. Do you think it makes work more productive when you're in your dedicated space at home?
Yeah, I do. I think it's way more productive to work from home, actually. Although, you know, I don't have kids yet, maybe one day, but right now I don't have kids. So I do find it a lot more productive. It means I can plan things and structure meetings and, you know, sequence my work in a way that suits me. And I tend to work very early in the morning. So between sort of 6 a.m. and 9 a.m., that's when I get most of my deep work done. I can optimize my work better. However, of course, there is a challenge there, because you might, you know, having those random ad hoc conversations can often be very, very beneficial. So yeah, I guess there's a trade-off there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And also, how do you stay hungry to improve? Because obviously this derives a lot from connections with people, with real people, with real emotions, and staying hungry at home can be challenging.
The challenge in healthcare, as you all know, there's just so much to fix. There's so many problems to fix. And really falling in love with the problem rather than, you know, the product you're working on or, you know, the mission that you have, I think is crucial. And that's how I stay motivated. I stay motivated by the problem that we're trying to solve. I think otherwise, I try to, you know, watch online conferences, although I'm very selective now because I have very little free time at the minute because there's so much going on, there's so much to do. But yeah, I think like online conferences are, you get good ones every now and again. And frankly, the fact that you don't need to travel, I find makes it a lot more inviting to attend that thing. And on that note, going back to the remote work side of things, you know, if you don't need to commute, you know, you often have, you know, an extra hour or hour and a half.
Any conferences that you can recommend? Maybe just a few.
Yeah. So recently, I guess, virtually attended Design Up, which was a fantastic conference that was in aid of COVID effort. And the organizers did an incredible job of organizing and pulling in some of the best designers in the world right now to share their knowledge in, as I said, in aid of India's COVID crisis. And yeah, so I heard from people like, you know, Stefan Sagmeister talking about his process and the artistic approach to design. And in his argument about how designers are potentially losing some of that creativity and what we can do about that. I listened to Daniel Berker, who was one of a design partner at GV, so Google Ventures. He was one of the pioneers of the Sprint, GV Sprint process. And he's now working on Simple Health, which is an incredible app that allows health professionals, nurses and the likes in well, anywhere in the world, but a lot of developing countries, to track hypertension. And hearing about his design process was really, really, really phenomenal. And it's that thing that really enthuses me and keeps me inspired while working at home.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing. And jump into your work at Babylon Health. So could you please tell me more about the product that you are working on, about HealthCheck, how it works, and your responsibilities?
Absolutely. So when I worked at Babylon, I worked on a few products, one of which was Health Check. And that was between November 2018, about March 2020, and just before COVID kicked off. Health Check is a health assessment. And when I worked on it, it was around 80 questions, so quite a long health assessment, asking people about everything from their family history to their daily habits and their medical history too. And at the end of this health assessment, after answering these questions, the user is presented with a representation of their health based on their age and gender habits. And as part of this, we presented a digital twin, which is an interesting concept that's actually come from engineering. So a digital twin traditionally is a digital representation of a system. And if you can imagine in a piece of machinery, you know, you would have, I think the easy example that most people would know is a wind tunnel. So you can simulate the effect of wind on aerodynamics on a car or a plane or something similar. So that would be a digital twin. And the idea with Health Check was that we actually present a digital twin of your body. Now, strictly speaking, this was perhaps an ambitious term to give it, but it was, simply put, it was a 3D model of a body that had visual representation of your different organs and what risk they have. And then it was accompanied by more traditional UI that represented your risk of, you know, different cancers or different, you know, diseases. So there's around 40 diseases when I worked on it. And that includes things like anxiety and depression as well. And as I said, this was a representation based on age and gender, and I'm sure we'll get into this, but it was by no means a diagnosis. That's not something that we can do without a particular medical device classification and things like that. And then finally, we moved into the area of extending that to simulation. So the real magic with a digital twin is going back to the car example and measuring aerodynamics. The real value is being able to simulate how different designs will change the aerodynamics of a car. And what we wanted to do was empower people to simulate their future health by saying, well, what if I didn't drink? What if I didn't smoke? What if I, you know, what if I ate 5,000 calories a day? What if I didn't sleep 8 hours a day? What if I slept for 4 hours a day? So you can begin to play around with your health in a hypothetical environment that would allow people or empower people to make better decisions about their health so that they're healthier in the future.
The survey is extremely long, so you must keep people motivated to finish it.
Yeah, so this was really interesting. So as product designers and product managers, we might hear that this assessment was, if I remember correctly, the assessment took 25 minutes on average.
Oh, wow.
So it's a very long assessment. However, the conversion rates of people that finished that assessment was significantly higher than the industry standard. Mm-hmm. While we can't scientifically say what the reason for that was, we, having gone through user interviews, so we did a lot of user testing, a lot of user interviews, really user-centered approach. We had ownership of this product, and the model was that the, you know, partners would pay for, so partners being, you know, NHS or you know, health providers, things like that, would pay for Health Check as an additional feature on their Babylon offering, and they would get, you know, the aggregated data, so the overall data, no personal data, of course, to give them better insight into how their population's health works. And we did a lot of user interviews to understand how to improve the product, but we had, you know, pretty much ownership of what we did. So what features we introduced, what things we tried, tested, what things we cut. And the The interesting thing with the health assessment was that we learned people were just so intrigued by this digital twin that they were very interested and curious to understand what that was and what theirs might look like. And for that reason, they were happy enough to answer all those questions, because there's a lot of them. It's worth noting that since I worked on it, there are less. So the assessment's been reduced, and there's some incredible work going on by the team there to get that down and to use the back end and different systems to pull a lot of data in to reduce the length of that assessment. But yeah, so it was essentially the promise of a digital twin that I suspect people thought or felt as though it was very personal. Again, in truth, it wasn't. It was based on their age and gender and the answers to those questions. So it felt personal for sure, but from a regulatory perspective, it wasn't a diagnosis.
And as you mentioned testing, could you please tell me more about these processes?
Yeah, so testing in Babylon and Health Check was, in hindsight, very luxurious. So we raised quite a lot of money back in, I think it was 2019, we raised 550 million. So it gives you an idea of the scale that we were working at. And in that respect, we were really quite spoiled. You know, we had incredible user researchers on the team, many of which I learned an awful lot from. That's done me very well in later parts of my career. And it meant that we could recruit people quite, you know, whenever we wanted, really. So we could recruit, and being healthcare and you know, consumer healthcare, B2C, we could quite easily recruit people as well. You know, we wanted to talk to people that, you know, maybe were in a particular age bracket, that felt as though they were fairly healthy, some not so much. But overall, it wasn't very hard to recruit these people. So we'd use recruitment firms and things like that to get these, you know, participants in, and we'd learn all about their health and their attitudes and behaviors towards health. And then also, you know, usually after that, when I was doing the interviewing and running the research, we'd do user testing of prototypes as well. And that was in different formats. The project where we were enabling people to simulate their health and how their risk of diseases might change depending on different health decisions started with a traditional GV design sprint, and then followed on from there, another fantastic designer Chris and I worked together in subsequent weeks to continue weekly design sprints so that we would test new prototypes each week. And this was 3 or 4 weeks, and by the end of it we managed to validate this, what eventually became a very, very simple and I would hope an elegant solution that was easily understood by users, very simple to build from an engineering perspective, and yeah, it couldn't have been really possible to get that traction and confidence in what we were doing without this testing.
So you're collaborating with user researchers, or you were doing testing on your own?
Yeah, so there's a combination. So when I started out, I think the first sort of 9 months or so, so about half the time I spent working on the health check, I would, trying to think. So yeah, I would plan and execute most of the research myself, usually with someone supporting, whether that's another designer or later another PM. But yes, so I would plan and conduct the interviews and be exhausted at the end of them. So very draining. Yeah, but there you might be interested to hear, actually, I was doing about the time that I was doing these back-to-back sprints, it would be on the Friday that we'd do the interviews. And I'm sure, you know, yourself maybe and many other designers and researchers would know, you get to a point where you're on autopilot. So a participant comes in and you give them a small talk, you introduce yourself, you introduce your colleague, they introduce themselves, and then you take them to the testing room. And you know, my small talk was the same at each point. So going down the elevator, small talk the same. Going up into the room, small talk the same. And then we'd sit down and then I'd make the same jokes and you know, It's very, very routine, right? And there was one interview at the end of the day, and we were waiting for a girl called Chloe. And a girl comes to the office, and you got to understand that at this point in Babylon, you know, we were hiring something like 40 people a week. We were going through this blitz scaling phase, which for those of you that don't know, is essentially just, you know, hire, raise an awful lot of money and hire a lot of people very aggressively so they can build, you know, your economic moat and so you can't be touched by anyone else. This girl came in and I said, "Hi, are you Chloe?" And she said, "Oh, yes." So I said, "Fantastic, come with me." Then I turned on the autopilot. And about 40 minutes into the interview, I admit I thought this is a bit strange, but I was too exhausted to really, you know, think too much of it. But my Slack started going crazy. You know, everyone was hitting me up in Slack. And then another person even rang me who would never ring me before. Someone at work.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So I thought this is odd. Anyway, so she was going through the prototype and testing it and answering a question. And then, yeah, as you can guess, I finished the interview, went downstairs. We had two buildings at the time, and I had this recruiter walk around a corner looking very, very angry. And at that point, I realized that I had taken the wrong person and done a user interview with a job applicant. But yeah, and then completely finished the interview.
That goes to show
how wide our recruitment requirements are for testing participants. But yeah, and then she, I think, as far as I know, so I turned to her and I said, "Hey, look, I'm really, really sorry. We've taken..." So I think she had, you know, a name that wasn't English, and she might have been used to English people messing up a name. So maybe she was nervous and she just said, "Oh, yes, that's me. It wasn't Chloe." So I turned to her and I said, "I'm so sorry. We're not the ones that I'm going to be talking to you." So she went back and the poor, you know, Chloe, the poor girl had been sat there for 50 minutes. And I said, "Hey, look, I'm, you know, sorry, it's been a mix up. You'll still get your, you know, your Amazon card or whatever." Yeah. And then this job applicant went on to her interview. And I'd like to think that I, you know, broke down her for her, because she went on to kill it in the interview, do really, really well. So.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure after this kind of. Start.
So it all went out well then, yeah.
Yeah, that's a nice story. And your interviews were offline, meaning that people have to really spend time to come to the office. And do you think it is really the best way to do these interviews? Is it really worthwhile?
Yeah, it's, you get, you know, advantages and disadvantages to both. There's different interviews that I've run, or different user research that I typically run in Health Check and beyond. For the most part, it was 2019. That's when I did most of this. And pre-pandemic, and with all this funding to recruit participants, it was very easy to do in-person interviewing. While sometimes a bit tiring, I guess. I think if you have the money and the space, which is a big if, because there's a lot of money and space that you need in central London, then yes, you know, it's really, really good, because you can build that rapport in person and you can, you know, get a better sense of body language and things like that. So it's really good way to do it. I have since, of course, you know, through 2020, done a lot of remote testing, so where I chat to them on camera and you know, get them to pull up a, you know, a prototype. That works really well. You know, you don't need the space, you can do it from anywhere, and people don't need to travel, and it's really good. However, it gets really challenging with the technology side of things. So first of all, if you have Zoom problems, then you know, that's a fundamental blocker, right? Or Google Hangouts problems or whatever. The other thing is having them get a prototype up on a phone. One of the biggest advantages of doing it in person is that you can have a test phone ready. So you can just pass the phone to them and say, "Tell me how you'd use this." So it's more streamlined to do in person for sure, but it's just more expensive. Can be more time consuming for travel and things like that. The other thing that I did a lot of was asynchronous tests. So remote asynchronous tests. And this was mostly comparative studies. And this is something I learned from an incredible user research called Anna. So this is using things like user Zoom or usertesting.com or any online testing service like that. And what you do in my case was you would have different prototypes combined with a survey. And you'd have this survey, the survey would be the same, but the prototypes would be different, where you'd have a control and then you'd have your variants. By having the same survey and using some interesting testing statistics techniques, you can measure, you know, each of the different, the control and the variants, and you measure it by gathering qualitative data. You actually combine it with quantitative questions. So you would say on a scale of 1 to 5, 1 being not at all, 5 being entirely, how confident are you that you completed this task? Or how much do you trust this website or this app? So they give a score, and then you'd say, give 3 reasons why. And 3 because it makes them think a bit more. And by doing this, you can actually assign, you know, this number to the trustworthiness of your control and then your variants, and then you can measure them. So you might find that variant 1 has, you know, an average trustworthiness score of 3.1, whereas variant 4 has an average score of, you know, 4.2. And that discrepancy between the two, or the delta, means that, you know, you want to understand better why did they trust 4 so much more. And that's when you can dig into the why. So you can go through the answers and use thematic analysis to pull out insights. You know, what is it that people find so much more trustworthy? And then you do that with different attributes of the design that you want to test. And then if you want more higher confidence, that's when you'd actually build things and test it that way as well. So it's a very user-centric way of going about it. So that gives an idea of, you know, in-person, you know, synchronous user testing, right through to asynchronous remote testing. And they're appropriate for different things, but they certainly have their place.
Mm-hmm. So you're showing a control and all variants to one person.
Correct, yes. Traditionally, you would. And to overcome the bias, yeah, so you mix it up. So you'd show control, then the first variant 1, then you'd show variant 1, and then the control to the other. The challenge with asynchronous, these kind of comparative studies, is you do need quite a lot more participants to get any degree of statistical significance worth, you know, making decisions on, which can, again, you know, I was incredibly spoiled in that I didn't have to think about the money side of things, but I suspect it can get fairly expensive when you have testing cohorts of 20 or 40.
Yeah, and speaking about the budget, do you believe that it makes sense to prompt users with some rewards?
So in the case of the user interviews that we ran, I think we provided as in gift cards. I think that was the reward. And then you make money, you make cash on these online services. So I think we did do sessions, or other designers and researchers did do sessions in Babylon where they would just ask people to come in and give their thoughts. That will give you, it tends to give you much more passionate, you know, advocates, let's say. It tends to be people that really like the company and are really passionate about sharing their thoughts and improving it. And that can be really beneficial, just because if you structure a study to focus on, you know, what are we doing right? What do we want to, you know, how do we want to push our product market fit, right? That can be really, really useful. But if you've got people that have that bias, then it's still a bias, right? It's a good one for you, for your company, but it's still a bias nonetheless. So you need to remember that, bear that in mind when you're making decisions on using the data in the future. The other challenge is when you pay people, you end up getting professional testers, which is a challenge in itself. But if you want people quickly that haven't used your app before, then it can just be a good way to do it. Yeah. So again, like all things, I think there's advantages and disadvantages to both.
Mm-hmm. And speaking about international expansion, so you had to work with people you cannot access offline, just by inviting to the office. So did you work with these segments separately?
We worked with partners to some degree or another. You know, we would have research agencies in different countries. There was one in Rwanda that we worked with. We would have, you know, people that had experience designing for these cultures. So one, a friend of mine worked on a health check, and he is Taiwanese, so we had some experience with, obviously, you know, the Mandarin translation. So it was very much, who do we have within the company that has experience working on products in these markets? And if not, how can we find and partner with, for example, user research agencies that know the local market and can help us navigate? Although I did work on international products and more specifically configuring our products for international markets, I didn't do so much design for them. Yeah, just the basic stuff, such as red, for example, has a very different sentiment in China. So red is for happiness and success in China. Now, you can imagine that doesn't work as well when you're trying to communicate the risk of, you know, high risk of cancer, right? Where, you know, initially at least we would communicate that with a bar, a UI card, for example, where it would have a bar and it would show you three different segments. And one was green, one was orange, one was red. So traffic light, traditional traffic light colors. And in the red, you were way above average risk for a particular disease. So that was an interesting challenge for how we designed that in markets like China. Another example would be one that I had to think about directly. So it's a one product that one feature that I worked on was simulating your sleep, your energy throughout the day, depending on your sleep and other factors. And within that, we would say, oh, you know, based on your sleep pattern, you know, your peak productive hour will be 1 o'clock. Maybe you should do your hardest tasks then. Now, that wasn't appropriate in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, for example, where they have national prayer times. So you got to be very mindful of things like that. And yeah, and that's when you come to talk to either colleagues in the company or outside to get mm-hmm. better understanding of the market.
I see, that is super challenging. And since you mentioned that the product was initially adopted by companies to assess the employees, so you had to work both with the company as a buyer and with users.
Yeah, so we had a B2B2C model. However, although we got some specific requirements from partners, so those examples would be good examples, actually. You know, if with working with KSA, Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and you know, the prayer times, and in the assessment, we couldn't ask things, it wasn't culturally appropriate for us to ask things about alcohol consumption, drug use, unprotected sex, things like that. And we had requirements like that where we had to configure the product, but again, in hindsight, very, very spoiled as a product designer, but we were quite, you know, in charge of what we did, you know, so what we designed and how we designed it. So it was very user-centered in that respect. Yeah, we didn't get many requirements from partners saying, you know, that we had to introduce an entire new feature or things like that. So yeah, very, very lucky.
After you've launched the product, did you have a chance to get feedback from users or from companies to improve it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So we would do kind of routine user testing for new features, or some of the user research team would actually do benchmark studies. So every 6 months or so, they would do a benchmark study to understand where are we at in terms of, you know, user experience, and what challenges do we have? How does it compare with, you know, the last benchmark study, things like that. And as part of that, in my case in particular, you know, when I would test new features, I would of course be very interested to know how do the previous features that we worked on resonate with them? So yeah.
And how did you measure success?
Yeah, so that was a challenging one actually, and that comes with having a very visionary CEO and a lot of money. It means that, you know, you are in charge of your own destiny to some degree, but actually measuring success when you don't have very clearly defined business metrics can just be quite, you know, challenging. So the easy measure was certainly conversion of people that completed the assessment, which was really quite high. It went down a little bit when we introduced more questions so that we could assess more diseases, but then, you know, the actual value that they got was, you know, we felt was worth it. The other measure of success that we did think about, but we didn't pursue in the end, was engagement. So weekly engagement, for example. The reason why we didn't pursue that was that health check as a health assessment is something that people tend to do and they get the result and they learn something about themselves and their lifestyle and the potential impact that might have and what they can do to change it and what risk they will have if they change it. And then some users came back and did it in 3 to 6 months again later when they'd made the changes, because some of these changes, you've got to make them for 6 weeks before in terms of clinical validity, we can actually say that, yes, you know, your risk is reduced. It wasn't something that really was appropriate for daily use or weekly use. So yeah, so the weekly engagement was something that, although we certainly talked about a lot, wasn't something that was appropriate or useful. So yeah, so we had conversion of the assessment, we had talked about engagement a bit, and then the other thing, of course, was just to measure your star rating, which was consistently high. And again, that comes back to, you know, this product that you use, you know, for an hour, maybe max, one off every 3 to 6 months, and then get value from, and then you know, evidently like it, right? So it scored highly, but yeah, we didn't really have any, I guess, realistic case at the time to try and push it as a weekly engagement product.
Also, actually, the business case as is also quite interesting, because a business is interested in learning more about the employees, how this can actually benefit the business. What are the next steps that they can take based on the results? Or you are expecting users to take these next steps?
Yeah. Yeah, so the partnering company that has licensed Health Check for their population, let's take a health provider. They give, you know, Health Check to their population for free. Their population does it. In return, they get this aggregated data. So this summarizing average data of their population's health. Now, if it turns out that their population is at a particular high risk of, you know, anxiety, let's say, then that gives them the data to say, okay, well, we need to invest in managing that anxiety. Otherwise, as we know, mental health can cost an awful lot of money further down the line, let alone things like diabetes or things like that. So it means that companies have more data on which to decide how to spend budget on employee benefits and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that totally makes sense. And speaking about you personally, what was your biggest challenge and insight from this project?
The biggest challenge was maybe not actually knowing, you know, what is the North Star metric that we're trying to move. And given that it tends to be a one-time use thing, or once every 3 or 6 months, and that people are happy with it, you know, what do we do now? and there is this huge gap, I think, between this vision of this, you know, real digital twin that was really accurate and represented your health, and, you know, by simulating health, you could, you know, make genuine informed decisions about what to change. between that vision and where we were, technologically, there is quite a delta between the two. There is a big gap that we needed to fill, and that would take a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of resource. So it was a challenge to think, well, what can we do day to day? What can we do tactically that fits into this broader vision, and what's our strategy for getting from where we are now to where we want to be?
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Listen to the second part of our conversation in the next episode and subscribe not to miss the update. Bye!